Thank you for joining me. I'm Kimberly Rogers, and you're listening to this week's Torah portion from Friday sundown to Saturday sundown. This message is brought to you by themessianicmessage.com. themessianicmessage.com. I hope that you enjoy this teaching. And before we get started, let's say a word of prayer. Baruch atah Yehovah Eloheinu melech haolam. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe, Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Creator of all things. We thank you and we praise you for your Torah and that you have called us to keep your Torah. We thank you and praise you for your Shabbats and for all the insights that you give to us. Please open our hearts and our ears and let my words fall to the ground, but let your words come back and be full of life. I pray in the name of Yeshua. Amen. I get excited every year at this time because I know that when Devarim comes around, it's not so far until we're going to be at Sukkot. And so I just love to see Devarim come. And of course, Devarim is my favorite book in the whole Bible, and I spend a lot of time reading it when I first got into the Hebrew Roots community, and I just love the message that Moses gives. Here he is recounting the history that the children of Israel have had for the previous 40 years. In this Torah portion, we have them standing gathered before him, where just in a couple of Torah portions ago, they were at war. 12,000 men had gone to war, and 12,000 men had come home. Why? Because Jehovah wanted to prove to them that he will be with them when they go to possess Canaan, to turn it into the land of Israel. You see, he is in the business of making sure that we understand he is able. So this generation that Moses is talking to has little or no memory of coming out of Egypt or crossing the Red Sea, depending upon how old they were when Moses uttered those words that everyone from 20 years old and upward will die in the wilderness. That meant that there were some who were 19 and under, and of course their children are the ones there gathered before Moses for him to give his final words. So this is not an entirely new generation, but mostly a new generation. All of the older generation have now passed away. So Devarim is Moses' summary statement. He is reminding them of theirs and their parents' history so they won't repeat it, because the Lord is still working toward plan A, remember? Now, the Mishnah says that Moses' words are words of rebuke, and it says that by naming the places, the incidents are immediately brought to mind, even for those who were not present at those particular places for those events. All the places mentioned bring to mind the hardship that disobedience brings, you see. The children of Israel were worried about going in to take the land of Israel, remember? But they probably fought more battles and lost more people by staying in the wilderness than they would have if they had just obeyed and gone in to take the land and been victorious under the Lord. Now, earlier, we had a Torah portion that was called Names. Now we have one that's called Words. And so we need to look into what are the words. And maybe these words have to do with the places. And later on, we're going to learn that indeed, there are some words having to do with the places that are important for us. So the words here are the unspoken stories that are associated with each place that is listed. That's part of what the words, or Devarim, is about. And as we go along, we'll get some more interesting information about what Devarim is about. Deuteronomy gets its name from Deuteronomy chapter 17, verses 18 and 19. Let's go over there and read that. And it shall be when he sits upon the throne, that's a king, when the children of Israel decide that they want to have a king, and when that king sits upon the throne of his kingdom, that he shall write him a copy of this law in a book, out of that which is before the priests, the Levites. And it shall be with him, and he shall read therein all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God, to keep all the words, the dabar, of this law, and these statutes to do them. So the book of Deuteronomy, Devarim, actually comes from the instruction given to kings about the words, the dabar. And so we need to understand that Deuteronomy, as well as the other four books of the Torah, are there for us to learn to fear the Lord our God. You see, it's not there just for us to hear it or read it and then not do it. We need to learn to fear the Lord our God and cause ourselves to do what we read. Now, scholars debate whether or not Moses actually wrote this book. The reason for that is because some people believe that Devarim contains a completely different set of commandments from those given in Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers. That idea actually comes from a mistranslation of a Greek word in the Septuagint, which says Moses delivered a second law. But Deuteronomy is also different from the preceding four books of the Torah in that it, number one, is mostly historical narrative into which law codes were inserted. This is another reason why the construct and the commandments vary. Two, it consists of the speeches that Moses delivered to the children of Israel as they prepared to enter the promised land. Three, instead of being composed from a variety of sources, it is essentially from one source, the person Moses. Instead of being framed as God's words to Moses and then Moses' words to Israel from God, Deuteronomy is framed as mostly Moses' words to Israel. And four, the name of God is referenced as Jehovah your Elohim. Jehovah your Elohim, you see? Now, we had the very first set of commandments that the first generation would not follow, given to us in Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers. But now this second generation, who has been taught Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, is getting ready to enter the land, and they need this reiteration of the laws. But there's some things missing in the book of Deuteronomy, and there are some things added in the book of Deuteronomy. And it's this variation that causes people to think that Moses was, some people even say, doing away with that Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers stuff, and giving a whole new set of commandments, and this is the set that we need to keep now, if you can believe that people would be that ridiculous. But now let's get back to looking at some of those variations. For instance, when the Lord gave the commandment not to commit idolatry, he gave us a couple of verses there in Exodus 20. Exodus 20, verses 4 and 5 say, "You shall not make any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. And you shall not bow down yourself to them, nor serve them. For I, the Lord, am your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation of them that hate me." But in Devarim 4, we get a long and detailed list of created things that the Lord says don't make an image of this. You see, so Moses is teaching the same thing that was given at Mount Sinai, but he's giving more commentary on it. You see, And now let me give you an example of a commandment that shows up in Leviticus, but does not show up in Devarim. Leviticus 19:32. You shall rise up before the hoary head and honor the face of the old man and fear your God. I am the Lord. So you see, we can find it both ways, that Deuteronomy expands on some of the commandments, and some of the other commandments are not in there. Here's another one that is in Deuteronomy or Devarim that is not in any of the other four books, and that is Deuteronomy 22:6. If a bird's nest chance to be before you in the way, in any tree or on the ground, whether they be young ones or eggs, and the dam sitting upon the young or upon the eggs, you shall not take the dam with the young. So it is clear now that there was a special purpose in the way Moses' final words were being given. And I believe it was to finish giving the commandments in order to complete the 613, as it were, and to emphasize those things most important to the children of Israel for their future, and those things with which the children of Israel had had trouble. Devarim is a structured and legal document, but it's also a prophetic document. And so we're going to take a look at why Devarim is a legal document and is structured like a legal document and at the same time is a prophetic one. As a legal document that also has prophetic significance, we must understand that Moses wrote and spoke it in such a way as to cause the children of Israel to recall their covenant with Jehovah. That's the legal part. The reason for him doing this is so that in the future, when those future prophesied events occurred, as they did in the writings, and that they will again in our future, they would know, and we will know, where the legal precedent comes from for Jehovah to put us through the bitter water ordeal and the fire baptism that will be our Red Sea incident, and it lays the precedent for how and why he can go against our enemies and fight on our behalf. Now, when this writer, his name is Cristoforo Unterberger, he's the author of the Torah of Moses, when he says, quote, Deuteronomy provided the key that unlocked the structure of the Torah and the prophets in modern scholarship. Close literary and historical study of this book inspired a revolution within biblical studies that opened new ways of viewing the Torah and the prophets of the Hebrew Bible. How did this happen? Once analysts linked Deuteronomy to the reform of King Josiah of Judah in the 1600s BCE, they realized that the principles articulated in this book provided the lens through which the history of Israel had been written in the books of Joshua through Kings. Well, the history actually proves the prophetic aspect of Devarim. This is also a provision for the legal basis for the actions that Jehovah took against his people back then and in the future. Folks, if you really want to know what Devarim is, it's actually a legal brief. Today, in the modern world, we call it a debriefing, you see. Simultaneously, it is a warning to that generation going into the land about what would happen to their ancestors, and in the end, it's a warning to us as well. The Apostle Paul understood that as well. He said that the things written in the Torah, that's the first five books, were given to us as examples. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, starting at verse 6, Paul also lists incidents in the desert, things that happened, events. So let's go and read those, starting at verse 6. Now these things were our examples, to the intent we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. Who is the they? Well, that's the children of Israel who were wandering in the wilderness. Neither be ye idolaters as some of them were, as it is written. The people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. We know that that is an incident referring to the golden calf. Neither let us commit fornication as some of them committed. That's referring to the men of Israel getting involved with the daughters of Midian. And they fell in one day 23,000. Neither let us tempt Yeshua, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed of serpents. Neither murmur you, as some of them also murmured and were destroyed of the destroyer. So you see, here we have a list of some of the larger incidents that happened in the wilderness. And so, with that, let's talk about what's going on in Deuteronomy 1:1. It's kind of got a tone here, this Torah portion. The opening sentence is the tone of a man who is, while tired, he is intent on making a point and leaving something of great value behind him, because he knows that this is his last chance to give testimony to the children of Israel. So the idea here is that he is repeating the former behavior by mentioning the places, as I said earlier. So Debarim also describes the punishments that will befall the children of Israel if they repeat those mistakes that their parents made, see? And, of course, the Lord knows that future generations will disobey. And so, in Deuteronomy 1:1, it says, "These are the words which Moses spoke to all Israel on this side Jordan, in the wilderness, in the plain, over against the Red Sea, between Paran and Tophel and Laban and Hazeroth and Dizahab." Now, that's how Moses begins the book of Deuteronomy, with this list of places that were, you know, where they committed major sins. Now, that generation that stood before Moses there were bond servants, you see. Their parents had committed them to being bond servants. But they became bond servants as a nation. I've taught on this before. We become bondservants as individuals by choice and not by physical birth. But those people, they were bondservants by physical birth, yet they still needed to make that spiritual choice, you see? And many of them did not make that spiritual choice. We today make this spiritual choice, but the physical one, you know, the one of which tribe do we belong to, will be made for us. So their physical choice was made for them. Our physical choice is not made for us. They were responsible for making their spiritual choice, and we are responsible for making our spiritual choice as well. One way or another, though, we're all bond servants. And because of the mutual bond servantship that was in that generation and that is in this generation, the book of Devarim intimately connects to the book of Revelation, because it is specifically written to two generations. First, to that one at Jordan, and then to the end time bond servants. Now, one of the most important teachings of Devarim is when Moses talks about the reason that he was not allowed to enter the land. Now, let's go and read Moshe's version of why he can't go into the land. We find it in Deuteronomy 1:37. "Also, the Lord was angry with me for your sakes, saying, 'You also shall not go in there.' So it is written that Moses was forbidden to enter the promised land because he disobeyed God and struck the rock, which was Yeshua. And what he was supposed to be doing there was teaching the children to make that spiritual choice by going up to the rock and speaking to the rock. You see, that was Moses' failure. But here is what God said about Moses entering the promised land. It goes back to Numbers chapter 20, verse 12. And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, because you believed me not to sanctify me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this congregation into the land which I have given them. Now, I need you to keep that phrase, this congregation, in your mind, because I think it's going to play into some prophecy. So, Moses appears in his statement there in Deuteronomy 1:37 to be blaming his consequences on others, or he denies what God said, or he is lying. I mean, those seem like that's, three possibilities there. But what could be the cause of the discrepancy between Moses' evaluation of what happened and what God said was the reason? Who are we to believe, God or Moses? Or, think about this, is there something else hidden here? Well, later in the book of Deuteronomy, in chapter 32, the Lord reiterates to Moses the reason that he can't enter into the land. And let's go over there at Deuteronomy 32:50, and it says, Die in the mount where you go up and be gathered to your people, as Aaron your brother died in Mount Hor and was gathered to his people. Because you trespassed against me among the children of Israel at the waters of Meribah Kadesh in the wilderness of Zin, because you sanctified me not in the midst of the children of Israel. So God is consistent here. He's telling the same story, yet Moses said there is another reason why he was not allowed to enter the promised land. In fact, Moses never even mentions the rock incident. So why is this? Well, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that there is a mystery hidden in there. And to uncover the mystery, we need to take a look at some of the words that Moses spoke in Deuteronomy 1:37. And one of those words in the King James Version is also. It says, also the Lord was angry with me for your sakes. You also shall not go in there. See, so the Lord never said, if we go back to Numbers chapter 20 verse 12, he never said, also Moses, you will not go. He said to both of them, Moses and Aaron, you shall not go. But he never said to Moses, like, you know, Aaron, you're not going to go, and Moses also, you're not going. No, Aaron did not get to go. So it can be said then that Moses was placing himself alongside Aaron, as in if he is saying Aaron and me also. So we're going to look at that Hebrew word also. That Hebrew word is gam. In Hebrew, it's Strong's 1571, and it means it's a contraction. It's also from an unused root meaning to gather properly, assemblage. So gam has to do with the gathering of the assembly. Because of the assembly not being able to go into the promised land, let me go out into a limb here, out on a limb, and say that it's possible that Moses didn't get to go, and that's maybe the hidden meaning. Maybe. Now, this is my personal opinion on this. But because of this word gam, and it's unused root, which means to assemble. And Moses is saying, Also, the Lord said I couldn't go. There's something having to do with the assembly. The assembly couldn't go. Moses couldn't go. So which assembly then are we speaking about? Are we speaking about that first assembly that did not get to go into the land of Israel? Or are we speaking about the last one? Well, possibly we are speaking about both of them. Now, hang in here with me, because I'm going to make this point. This could be a hint, you see. Moses, in this Torah portion, is speaking many years after the Kadesh Meribah incident, where he struck the rock. But is it possible, do you think, that the Lord revealed to him a larger picture, perhaps underlying a reason having to do with another generation? Have you ever experienced something? You did something or something happened to you, and you might not have thought about it for many years, and then one day you remember the incident because something happened. And you look back on the original incident, and now you see something more involved there. Have you ever felt like the Lord revealed something to you about your personal life, and now you understand the incident, and you understand the mistake you made, and how the Lord is going to use that for your good? You see, have you ever had that experience where you've done something and now the Lord is going to use it for the good of you and the good of the kingdom? And maybe that's what's going on here with the discrepancies between Moses' account and what the Lord says. I'm thinking that somewhere along the line, Moses realized that the Lord was going to use this incident for his good and for the good of the kingdom and for the good of the last generation. Now you hang in here with me and I'll show you this. You see, because it's as if Moses did not get to go into the promised land because he had not yet delivered all of the children of Israel. It's as if, like, you know, Messiah said, it wasn't his time. So is the hidden meaning in this story of Kadesh Meribah possibly that Moses will enter the promised land with the last generation, those who are alive and have endured the tribulation? You know, Yeshua made it clear that God has a time for everything, and we also know that all things work together for good to them that love the Lord. And so the Lord can take a messy situation and can turn it around and make it good for his kingdom. And I'm wondering if that's not what is happening here, and Moses knows it. Moses has been given the insight that he's going to play a role into actually delivering a generation into the promised land. So hang in here with me, because God has timing for everything. In John chapter 7, verse 6, Yeshua said to them, "My time is not yet come." And in Matthew 26:18, he said, "Go to the city to such a man and say to him, the master says, my time is at hand." So you see, the Lord is in control of all the timing, and it's just awesome how he can use the messes we make for the good of his kingdom. Ecclesiastes chapter 3 is all about appropriate time and timing as well. So I think that it's possible that that Moses' time will be at the end, that the Lord was angry with him and would not let him deliver that first generation, but that he will be able to be involved in delivering the last generation, which, and here's the punchline, that maybe Moses will be one of the two witnesses that we read about in the book of Revelation. Now, I'm not going to go into a very deep study of that right now. I'm just kind of laying it out as possible evidence that would verify what some people believe, that Moses will be one of the two witnesses. And in fact, you'll remember that Moses was present with Yeshua at the Mount of Transfiguration. This being said, Moses' punishment must have a much deeper meaning, right? Because why would God punish Moses and then resurrect him early so that he could appear with Yeshua on the mount? And since Moses was with Yeshua then, is it possible that Moses will accompany Yeshua again or be present with the other saints at the final restoration of the house of Jacob? And what about Elijah? Well, Elijah is a type and shadow of John the Baptist, but not of Messiah. And Elijah is a type and shadow of the message at the end that is part of the restoration of the house of Jacob, but Elijah is not a type and shadow of the Messiah so much, but Moses is a type of Messiah, right? And the Messiah is preceded by Elijah, and they were together in the land, remember? And so you had John the Baptist, and you had Messiah. And so you have, at the end, Elijah representing John the Baptist, or the Elijah message again. And you have Moses, the type of Messiah, right? Who are maybe the two witnesses. See, we don't know very much about those two witnesses, and we're just speculating now. But Yeshua, the Messiah, is going to be the one to deliver us into the promised land. But it seems to me that Moses' entry was delayed until the time that Yeshua delivers us into the promised land. And it's as if Yeshua is bringing Moses along so that Moses can deliver a generation into the promised land. I believe there's a message of forgiveness in there, don't you? And I think that there are clues about this in Moses' presence with Yeshua on the Mount of Transfiguration. You see? And there is something else that's very interesting about the two Exoduses. The first Exodus was a physical deliverance from the land of Egypt. And the second Exodus is a spiritual deliverance, you see? So we have first a physical deliverance and then second a spiritual one. And since we're going to be faced with the same tests that they were faced with in the wilderness, I think it behooves us to go back to Deuteronomy 1:1 and take a look at what that all means there, you see. Let's go back to Deuteronomy 1:1 and let's take a look at what means the phrase in the wilderness. Well, that in the wilderness phrase refers back to the desert wilderness. And what happened in the desert wilderness? Well, let's go back to Exodus 16, verse 1. And they took their journey from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came into the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after their departing out of the land of Egypt. And the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the children of Israel said to them, "Would to God we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots, and when we did eat bread to the full. For you've brought us forth into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." Now, let's remember what happened on the 14th day of that first month. Of course, we know it was Passover, and all the firstborns were redeemed. 1 month and 1 day later, the children of Israel are complaining of being without food. Now, this generation that we're in right now, where we have an attitude and a behavior, and we believe that we are entitled to being cared for by the beast government. So some of the people that are going to be in the camps will complain about the lack of whatever, money, food, comfort. The lesson, though, for us is that we need to not be complainers even when we're tired and hungry and scared, you see. Now, the reference to the plain comes from Numbers 25, verses 1 to 9, where the children of Israel accepted the pagan god Peor in their midst. So, we're going to have paganism coming into the camps as well. And then Moses talks about the Red Sea. What happened at the Red Sea that Moses needed to remind them about? Well, Exodus 14:11 says, "And they said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, that you've brought us away to die in the wilderness, wherefore have you dealt thus with us to carry us forth out of Egypt?" You see, these people are very sarcastic. They were, at that point, there in Exodus 14:11, hemmed in on all sides except they could go forward, but forward was through the water. And they got this really nasty attitude. So, this is going to be another situation that we're going to face that, you know, people are going to have very nasty attitudes. In fact, if you're paying attention to the Hebrew Roots movement at all, you'll notice that there are a lot of people in our midst that already do have nasty attitudes. Now, let's go on to the next locations, which are Paran, Tophel, and Lavan. At Paran was the incident with the 12 scouts being sent into the Promised Land to gather information prior to what would have been their entry into the land just a little more than 2 years after they came out of Egypt. And that we find in Numbers chapter 10, verse 12. "And the children of Israel took their journeys out of the wilderness of Sinai, and the cloud rested in the wilderness of Paran." And then Lavan is the place where they complained about the manna. Let's go over to Numbers 11 and go to verse 9, and we'll see what happened there at Lavan. "And when the dew fell upon the camp in the night, the manna fell upon it. Then Moses heard the people weep throughout their families, every man in the door of his tent, and the anger of the Lord was kindled greatly. Moses also was displeased. And Moses said to the Lord, 'Why have you afflicted your servant, and why have I not found favor in your sight, that you lay the burden of this people upon me? Have I conceived all this people? Have I begotten them, that you should say to me, "Carry them in your bosom, as a nursing father bears the sucking child, unto the land which you swore to their fathers"? Whence should I have flesh to give all this people? For they weep to me, saying, 'Give us flesh that we may eat.'" And then at Tophel, Tophel was in the Paran desert, but this is where Miriam was struck with leprosy, and we read about that in Numbers chapter 12. Hazeroth is the place where the insurrection of Korah took place. You see, we're going to have people who are going to try to create their own faction within the camps of the righteous. Dizahav means enough gold, literally. Dizahav. Zahav is gold. D is enough. Enough gold. That's the golden calf incident. And so what we're learning here is that all of these places are actually examples of wrong attitudes. And wrong attitudes lead to the commission of sin. This is why we need to get our attitudes adjusted when we're going through the Great Tribulation. That's one of the things that the Great Tribulation is for. It's to get our attitude adjusted before we go into the land. Now, I also want to draw your attention to an anomaly. First, we've had the discussion about, you know, the structure of Deuteronomy and what it really is, which is it's a debriefing session that Moses is having for 5 weeks with the children of Israel. And then we had maybe a hidden meaning of how the Lord is going to use Moses in the end of days to possibly help to bring the children to deliver a generation You know, because Moses was going to deliver that first generation and he didn't get to, so maybe, you know, he'll be instrumental in delivering the last generation. As one of the witnesses, we'll have to wait and see on that. And then we went through this list of places, and there's an anomaly in the sequence in the way that they're listed in Deuteronomy and opposed to the way that they're listed throughout the scriptures. Now, sequentially in Scripture, we see them as the Red Sea incident, the desert wilderness, Di-Sahav, Paran, Tophel, Levan, and Hazeroth, and the plain, you see. And Moses' list, though, is different. It is the desert wilderness, the plain, the Red Sea, Paran, Tophel, Levan, Hazeroth, and Di-Sahav. Again, I'm asking you to consider something that I'm going to present to you, just like with the Moses thing, and I hope I explained that well. Do you think it's possible that this seemingly insignificant switching of events could be prophetic? Well, of course, you know me, I believe it's possible. Why? Because there is a prophetic teaching that at the second Exodus, we will leave peaceably and without the ruckus of the first Exodus. Therefore, the first thing that we will face is hunger. So the first thing is that we'll have the complaint of no food. We won't have first the complaint of the Red Sea, meeting up at the Red Sea the way that they did the first time, you see. So this makes sense because our situation is different than was found during the situation in the first Exodus. We will not be running from the government in the second Exodus the way that they did in the first one, but you do have to be aware that you will not be able to take enough food and supplies to last for 3.5 years, so our first trial will be hunger. So just like the children of Israel, the food is going to run out about 1 month and 1 day into our wilderness stay, and this is going to be our first incident, even though for the children of Israel, it was the second incident, you see. And of course, the very next thing that we will face will be idolatry, because we're going to be bringing a bunch of people with us, and if they're coming out of Christianity, they're going to want to bring their idolatry. And the next thing that we're going to face is a Red Sea incident. And I've talked on this before, that our Red Sea incident will be different than theirs. We are going to be facing other things that could possibly be our Red Sea incident. Some of that probably having to do with fire baptism rather than water baptism, and possibly even facing up to Esau, because Esau means red, and I've taught on that in the Esau effect. So if you want to understand what I'm talking about there, just go back and listen to the Esau effect. And then, you know, we may have some people wanting to go out of the camp to be scouts. And I don't know exactly how that's going to, play out. But then we'll have Tophel, where you're going to have someone belittling the leadership and ending up with leprosy. Then we're going to be following that up by another food incident where we're going to be tired of the food, you know, that Abba supplies us. And we're going to start wanting our, you know, McDonald's hamburgers or such things. Then we are going to have the Korah incident at our Hazeroth, which will be the outright rebellion against the leaders of the camp. And then we will come to Di-Sahav, because in the camps, people are going to think that Yeshua is not arriving in time. And they will say, well, we need to set up our own little system here, just like they did when they were waiting on Moses to come down from the mountains. We're going to be waiting on the Lord to come down from the mountain. And so, ain't it going to be fun? Well, in Deuteronomy chapter 3, verse 28, which is at the end of the Torah portion, Moses tells the people to encourage and strengthen Joshua. He says, "But charge Joshua and encourage him and strengthen him, for he shall go over before this people, and he shall cause them to inherit the land which you shall see." Now, I'm going to tie this back into what I said about Moses possibly being allowed by the Lord to be involved in delivering this final generation. And so let's take a look in this verse at who is the he and who is the them. Someone is going to cause them to inherit the land that this second generation is going to see very soon. Now let's stop for a minute. The reference word he is obviously to Joshua, but it can also be a reference to Yeshua. And it could possibly be a reference to the leaders, those 144,000 leaders of the camps at the end. Ultimately, it will be Yeshua that causes them, which is us and those who will be resurrected, to inherit the land. So here we have the end of Moses recounting their trials and tribulations and his trials and tribulations as a shepherd, and his instruction to uphold Joshua. And why is it important for people to support and encourage Joshua or to encourage the shepherd after Moses is gone? It is because that shepherd will cause them to inherit the land. And isn't that the job of the shepherd? That little last bit of instruction is so valuable for us today in the Hebrew Roots community, because we're so splintered with people running around everywhere doing their own thing rather than throwing their support and encouragement and their full weight behind someone who has been anointed for the purpose. And I'm not here to say that this one is anointed and that one is not anointed. But I can tell you that we've got enough troubles in the Hebrew Roots community with people stepping out, forming their own groups, and basing it on one or two things that they have glommed on to and said, this is, you know, this is my thing. I'm a calendar person, or I'm a sacred name person, or I'm a this person or that person. And they gather other people to them based on their little pet doctrine. That's not anointing, folks. That's kingdom building. So, I hope that we can learn from this very valuable lesson and get encouragement for what is coming in the future, and maybe have a mystery or two to chew on until these things actually come to pass. I hope this teaching has been a blessing to you. Shabbat Shalom.